Hello, everyone, and welcome back to eLearning DIY. Summer, as you know, we take our summers off here, but we're back rolling in September. Today's topic is onboarding employees and the benefits of onboarding and the best practices associated with onboarding. But before me and Lindsay get started on this presentation, we have a few reminders. One, if you have any questions during the presentation, please feel free to use the chat at the bottom right-hand side of your screen and type out your questions and send them in. Obviously, we will do our best to answer them during the presentation, but if we are unable to do that, we will be sure to follow up with you after the presentation with answers to those questions. If you ever missed any of our past webinars, new clients, you want to kind of review our past webinars, you can find a recording over at e2rsolutions.com. And the PowerPoint presentations of those will be found in your member portals. Lastly, we just take this opportunity to remind you all that the information contained within our webinars is an overview of the law only, and it's not intended as an analysis of all areas of employment and labor law, and accordingly should not be relied upon as legal advice for any given situation. As always, for any specific questions related to the information in this webinar or any other topic for that matter, please reach out and we will address them individually. Also, lastly, mark your calendars for October 25th because that will be our next e-learning. So let's get started. So with the benefits of employees, we're going to go through the benefits of onboarding. Obviously, it's important to start the relationship off on the right foot. We're going to see why and also how important that is. We're then going to identify some of the keys to successful onboarding program. We're going to run through what your new hire checklist should look like, which will really help with your onboarding programs. We will do a brief overview of the training requirements for new employees in three of the larger provinces, Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia, and then we'll wrap it up with a nice bow on it. So without further ado, I'm going to pass it over to Lindsay.
Good to be back. So the first benefit of onboarding, there is no doubt that successful onboarding is going to lead to higher retention and lower turnover among your staff. That is, you know, a huge benefit to employers when you are bringing on an employee. One of the benefits is that right from early on, you can establish if the employee you hired is the right fit. It also sets levels, right? So an onboarding program should set those expectations very clearly, so employees are clear in their mind what's expected of them. It also just creates and opens the lines of communication between your new hire, their team, HR, and builds a strong foundation for the intangible elements that sometimes get missed. So things like your company culture and your country. A brief study because we obviously in preparation and writing this done some research on onboarding. And the recent studies structured onboarding process doesn't just prepare employees for a new position point in their new career, which is right at the beginning. That is directly going to relate to increased performance. Unfortunately, recent research done by Gallup, they surveyed employees and organization does a great job on new employees. So I think it's one of those things too much attention on, but can lead to huge benefits to the company. Obviously, with respect to retention, high retention means less money, time, and effort spent on the newcomer. And I was actually quite surprised by this statistic, and it's a recent statistic by the Society for Human Resource Management, or SHRM. They estimate 6 to 9 users use an average employee, looking at $20,000 to $30,000 to replace an employee loss associated with the entire recruitment and selection phase, and then onboarding. So, and then all of the time and energy once again onboarding that replacement. So, you know, when we look at the dollars in terms of retention and turnover, it only makes sense to implement a really strong onboarding program. What else does onboarding do? You know, the second point is that it fosters employee engagement. And another interesting statistic by Gallup shows that employees had 147% higher earnings per share than their competition. Once again, there is no doubt that engaged employees make for higher performers and more profitable companies, substantially more profitable companies than the competitors. So, you know, sometimes we think of, again, you know, the onboarding is simply just an orientation to the employee's position, but in fact, the onboarding can extend past that and actually foster engagement with your employees. So a third point is onboarding ensures compliance with organizational policies. So, you know, all through our clients know that, you know, what we recommend is that you provide your employee handbook alongside the employment agreement for that new employee to read and review prior to their first day of work. But, I mean, realistically, an employee handbook is a lot of information for an individual to absorb without any real context, right? They can read the policies, but they haven't stepped foot in your door yet. And so it's a lot of information to absorb, to take in, and there's maybe some uncertainty in terms of how these policies are actually applied. So in onboarding, by going through some of your key organizational policies right at the very beginning of employment, you no doubt more easily ingrain in those employees how things are done in your workplace. And then those new employees will be able to apply the policies immediately to their new job.
And the benefits aren't coming. One of the main benefits, really, especially if you operate in an industry where there are possibilities for workplace accidents, onboarding and orient an employee is one of the best ways to prevent workplace accidents. And there's been a couple studies done, one by WorkSafe BC, where they found that more than half of the workplace accidents involving new work just to make sure that we can minimize those accidents. And that is also echoed by the Ontario Ministry of Labour, where they've also found that they're kind of three times more likely to be injured during the month on the job than an experienced worker. So obviously, from employees are more likely to injure themselves at work, but that can be reduced by making sure that we're doing the proper training, the proper mentorship, the proper guidance, all of that right from the first shift, really. And that also meets your obligations on our health and safety system. We'll get into that again. And then the last kind of benefit that we've identified, and there are more benefits, obviously, is onboarding does happen between the employee and the organization in general, and the employee and our managers in particular. So when you are taking onboarding seriously, it does show a commitment to that employee that this is an important relationship, and everyone wants to feel important and valued. And if that is conveyed on day one through an organized onboarding process, all the better. Just imagine showing up to work on your first day and there's no one there to greet you. Someone, oh, I don't know who you are, or you're kind of scrambling to put the person on the workspace together. Those types of things do send a negative message to your new employees. We want to make sure that, also, it's going to allow the employees to get to know people within the company. It's important to form those relationships right off the top. And so when we introduce people to their coworkers, to other people that are important, they're going to feel more welcome. Maybe have a welcome lunch, kind of like with a smaller team if your workplace is larger. Those types of things. And we're also going to want to make it very, very clear that if they have questions, we have answers. And so if we have someone there onboarding them, it's going to just create a bit of a story answer, and they are an important part of your company from day one.
So let's move into the keys to a successful onboarding program. So that, the next slide is, how do we do this right? To make sure that we are taking advantage of all those benefits that we just talked about. And this really plays well into what Alex was just saying. And so, you know, if we also take a minute to think about changing jobs, and I'm sure everyone listening at one point in time in their career felt in that period of time where you resigned from your current employer, and perhaps there are 2, maybe 3 weeks where you are working out your resignation notice period before you start that new job. There is certainly a level of perhaps anxiety, did I make the right decision? And I think more often than not, in that 2 or 3 week period of time where there is simply no communication with your newcomer between when they signed the employment agreement to their very first day when they walk in the door. No interaction in between. And really, one of the very first keys to a successful onboarding program is today. So really, onboarding should begin as soon as the employee signs and returns the employment agreement. Because again, that period of time between quitting one job and starting another can be a little unsettling. So ideally, you want to be in touch with technology. There's actually onboarding apps now that are used to bridge that gap. So it's a way for, and you know, everybody likes these apps and they're always on their phone. So, you know, sort of inventive technology companies have created onboarding apps that actually allow you to stay connected to your new during this sort of gap between quitting a job and starting another, which I find pretty good. So another key to a successful program is to make it personal and really try to create an experience. Orientation programs were really designed and applied to every new employee. Didn't matter if you were management, a plant worker, office employee, you know, something created, designed, and implemented. And really, sort of the trend now is to make it more personal and create more of an experience and sort of idea that fits all formula. So really, what to consider is that everyone's onboarding program should be different in content and structure. That should relate specifically to the individual newcomer's needs. So, you know, think about what's the role, what tools and processes they need to learn about in their first teams within the roles of your newcomers, but really we should be looking at customizing the program to suit each particular role and what they need to really get off on the foot. And sort of in that same vein is the idea to blend the onboarding journey. And so is to design really, again, an experience for your new employee by sort of mixing it up. So, you know, again, traditional orientations is you sit in the, maybe you sit with the payroll for a bit and you go to your manager. And really, you know, a successful onboarding program is designed to create an exciting experience. So it mixes formal, so again, those boardroom meetings, social, so perhaps a lunch or some sort of organized, more social event with some key team members, and then workplace learning, of course. So, you know, you're on the job training based on clear goals. So really think about sort of mixing it up in terms of the elements of the onboarding program to really create a more interesting and exciting experience.
Another key to a successful onboarding program is going to ensure that that new employee knows how to access local experts within your company. So, for example, who to contact for IT issues, who are the HR people, who's the HR person that they're supposed to be contacting with, who's the payroll contact, any questions about payroll, who that person is. Other teams that they may need to be interacting with, like who are the leaders of those teams, things just to orient the person to have a little sense of kind of security and knowing kind of where to reach out to get answers to certain questions. We also need to ensure one of the keys is going to be making sure everyone's on the same page, right? So we want to make sure that everyone is committed the onboarding process from the new employees themselves, obviously making them feel welcome is going to be key to get their engagement in the onboarding program. And the line managers and the human resources, and it's like a house of cards. If one person is committed to the process, it's just not going to be as successful as if everyone is committed. And then one other thing you might want to consider is kind of specific instructions as well to their job and how to carry that out. So I think there's a couple more things to go through, and then we'll get to our new hardship checklist.
Everybody's on the same page in terms of your onboarding program. We also want to make sure we're promoting inclusion and assimilation. So one of the ways that we can do that is to make sure that the new employees' peers and colleagues are prepared. So you know, arriving your first day and nobody knew you were coming, nobody knows your name, nobody's expecting you. And so one of the ways that you can really promote inclusion and assimilation, particularly into the employees' key team, is to prepare the peers and colleagues, the existing employees, by helping them understand who's joining, what their role will be, and what they're bringing to the team, right? So usually onboarding really focuses is just as important for prepare other team members, existing employees, for their arrival as well. So finally, you know, we want to make sure in our onboarding program we are transforming training into performance, right? We want to make sure that this new employee can be as productive as possible as quickly as possible. And so we want to ensure that the onboarding program's objectives are set and clear to enable evaluation and measurement of its success. And in terms of just sort of measuring the success of the onboarding program, generally, just as a side note, many spend the sort of the money, the time, and the energy to create an onboarding program are using the opportunity then to evaluate that program. So whether that's, you know, 6 months into employment, they may send out a quick survey just to that those new employees to say, hey, what did you think of our onboarding program? What was good? What wasn't good? Where could we improve? Because any time you're, you know, creating a program like this, you want to make sure that it's meeting your objectives. So getting some feedback certainly doesn't hurt. Particularly if this is something that you're going to be developing from scratch and implementing new in your organization, sometimes it's good to get some feedback, and ideally you get that while the individual is still your employee and not necessarily sometimes where it happens is in an exit interview. So adding to the onboarding program some sort of measurement mechanism so you can get some feedback.
One of the great ways to facilitate a successful onboarding process is to develop a new hire checklist. This is going to help you prepare for that employee's first day. And there's going to be things that you're going to do in advance of the first day, like Lindsay spoke about during that kind of soft period, that unknown period between leaving your old job and kind of starting a new job, as well as things that they're going to need to do on the first day. And so it's going to give you some, I guess, some peace of mind that you don't need to worry about keeping track of all the things that you need to do. So it's just going to simply be a guide for you to go through so you can focus on more important things on that new hire's first day. For example, letting them meet their team and meeting certain kind of important kind of stakeholders in the organization, as opposed to you trying to figure out, okay, what needs to be done now off the top of your head. It's all going to be there kind of very clearly so you can follow it to a T. And it's also going to also allow you to share it amongst all the people involved in the onboarding program. So you're going to know what your tasks are. You're going to know what the manager's tasks are. You're going to know what the IT person's tasks are going to be. So it's going to just kind of make it a bit more clear as to who needs to do what, and to make sure that we get through all the things that we need to get through, and we can focus on having a successful first day for that person and first few weeks, rather, too. So that new hire checklist, there's going to be things that you're going to want to put in there that are going to need to be done before the person's start date. And you've heard me talk about this every single one of these e-learnings, and that's the importance of the employment agreement. We're going to want to make sure that there's a very clear box on that checklist that says, I have gotten on the signed employment contract from my new hire. They've gotten on the handbook, if we're giving them a handbook in advance to sign off on. We want to make sure that that is in our pocket and that box has been checked. Otherwise, as we all know, there might be some enforceability issues with that very important employment contract. We're also going to want to have a staff email essentially introducing the new employee to existing staff, just so everyone knows that on Monday, our new employee will be starting. This is their role, and we're welcoming them, even though they're not likely getting that email. We find it very funny when I see these welcome emails that says, welcome aboard, we're really happy to have them. They're not seeing all these nice kind of platitudes about themselves. However, it is showing that that person is important to the organization and allows all the coworkers to know that to expect a new face come Monday.
You know, just on that point, Alex, and I don't know how many people are doing this, but, you know, one of the things to consider is, you know, if you've got that person's email set up, is copy them on that email. Because it would be that, you know, if I'm starting a new job and I come in and I'm opening my email for the first time on my first day and I see, a week ago, they actually sent this really nice email welcoming me. So I don't know how much of you are doing that who are on the phone, but, you know, one of the things maybe you can start doing is just copy your new employee on that email.
Absolutely. And then so also one of the things you're going to want to make sure that, like, you're sharing the onboarding plan with all the people that need to know about it. And then from a practical perspective, you're going to want to make sure that you have advised employee where they're to report, when they're supposed to come, just so they don't come early or they come late on their first day, who they're going to be meeting with once they arrive. Again, we don't want someone to not know and they're walking in and they're saying, oh, I'm new here, who do I speak to? That's not how we want to start things off. And then also just kind of practical stuff, like where are they going to park if they're driving? Even helping them get there on public transit, just getting them information, useful, practical information on what they need to know to get to work on that first day.
I think those are obviously just a couple of points we've added here, but, you know, when we're talking about the onboarding program and really creating an experience and customizing, this information that you're going to provide to the new employee prior to starting is really going to vary based on that new hire. So obviously there are some things that, you know, you want to make sure you absolutely communicate, and then there's going to be other things that, you know, based on the nature of their role, their work location, that you're going to obviously add to this list. So, you know, and I think this sort of goes without saying, but, you know, for a new hire, having an office or a workspace set up, all set up in time for their first day is critical. It's going to make them feel welcome, and it shows, again, that the company has, in fact, prepared for their arrival. So, office setup. Make sure they've got a workspace, they've got all the necessary furniture, they've got a chair to sit in, they've been added to all of the appropriate directories, perhaps they've had business cards ordered, set up all their security access. You know, one of the things, you know, obviously on their new day, they're not going to have their security pass, but if you require that to get into the building, they don't have that on their second day of work, to be able to just come in and find their workspace, again, it sort of creates that level of discomfort. So we really want to make sure that we've done everything in advance to show that we've prepared for their arrival. Same thing with IT, right? Their computer should be there, they should have their email address set up. Should be giving them all of their login instructions to get onto the network, their phone, their, you know, whatever they need in terms of IT. If you're giving them a cell phone or smartphone, obviously if they're telecommuting, then you're going to want to make sure that their home office is set up. But really, sort of the point of this all is that this should be all taken care of, so the new employee's first day is more productive. And that it's not spent, you know, trying to figure out how to get into their email or set up their voicemail. We really want to make sure that this is as easy as possible And again, right, the idea is that we want this employee to be as productive for the company as soon as possible. So getting all this done will only help that. So of course, we can't forget the administrative side of onboarding. So we've included some information with respect to payroll-specific requirements. And obviously, this may vary slightly depending on your organization and what forms you have employees complete. But no doubt at some point on the employee's first day, we'll be spending some time with your payroll person. And some of this stuff can be done in advance, right? You could say to the employee, here's the new hire form, fill it out. You know, make sure you bring with you a voided check. So some of this stuff you can actually accomplish before, again, spending less time doing paperwork, more time being productive. But obviously, we want to make sure this stuff is done, right? We want to make sure that the employee gets paid in a timely manner. If there's any future electronic pay statements or electronic T4s, you want to make sure that all of that authorization paperwork is filled out. Even benefit enrollments and waiver forms. So even though you may have a waiting period of 3 months, say, before an employee can actually enroll and take advantage of your benefits, sometimes I find that those enrollment forms are completed closer to the end of that 3 month period, and it may in fact cause some delay in terms of enrollment. So you can actually get the employee to fill out those forms now, and likely they'll still be good in 3 months, and at least that's done, and there's no delay whatsoever when their benefits take effect. And then of course the tax forms, the source deduction return forms, get all those filled out. And if this individual is subject to a collective agreement, then you know this may be an opportunity where you're providing some information in that respect, or from a payroll perspective, some further information as it relates to any.
One of your legal obligations as an employer in this country is to make sure that your new employee is legally eligible to work in this country. So what you're going to need to do in that regard is you're going to be kind of requesting the employee's social insurance number. Now, we don't want to be requesting that information before a conditional offer of employment has been made. That request could disclose some information about that individual that that individual could then assume it was the basis for their not being kind of offered employment. So we only should be asking that information once a conditional offer has been made. And quite frankly, you can do that on their first day. You are supposed to inspect kind of physically that card that the employee does provide to you. We're not supposed to be taking a photocopy of the SIM card. I know kind of myself growing up, I must have given out a million copies of my SIM card to a bunch of different employers along the way, only to find out when I became a labor and employment lawyer that that wasn't something that should be asked for. So just keep that in mind. We're going to have to just kind of make sure we're physically inspecting that card. Now, if an individual shows up and says, I have a work permit or I have a permanent residency card, but I don't have a social insurance number or a social insurance card, you can direct them to go to the nearest Service Canada office, and assuming that everything is in order, they should be able to get that SIM card in one visit. So it's, I guess, one of the efficient things that our government does actually do. If you have any questions about the validity of someone's SIN, you're kind of questioning whether it is in fact the person that is listed on that card. There is a number online that you can call to ask them about the validity of a SIM card and who it belongs to. So just keep that in mind as a resource. Now, one of the things you're always going to be checking for as well as with SIM cards is, does that SIM number start with a number 9? If they start with a number 9, it means that person is not a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident. So that means that they've been given a SIN because they are a temporary worker and they have a work permit. Now, those work permits have certain expiry dates, as does the SIN number. So when we see a CIN that starts with 9, the next question is going to be, we need to see your immigration document. So what's the work permit? What's the study permit? We need to make sure that it has not expired. I had a client the other day who did an offer of employment to someone. That person did provide a work permit, only to realize that the work permit was actually kind of linked to a specific employer, and that employer was not them. And so we want to make sure that everything is very clearly open work permit, those types of things. If there's any questions related to that, we can try to help you. And if we can't help you, then we can definitely put you in touch with an immigration lawyer who can. But let's make sure that we're doing what we need to do as it relates to that. And so another obligation, as I mentioned before, you can't take a photocopy of a CIN, but you do need to protect it. So if it's written down, you need to make sure that that's written down in an employee's file and not everyone has access to that information. We should all be protecting our own SINs and protecting on the SINs of our employees. And when I say SINs, I say social insurance number, not their SINs. After I said SIN over and over again, I can see how that might be taken out of context, but I'm talking social insurance numbers only.
And that's with respect to if the name on the SIN is different than what the name the employee goes by, so by surname. So, you know, my surname on my SIN is different from the surname that I actually use, and what should be used from a payroll perspective. So in terms of guidance in that respect, the Canadian Payroll Association, their recommendation is that you use whatever name is on the SIN. If an employee wants that name, their whatever, married or non-married name, to be used in payroll, you have to use whatever is on the SIN, because that's what is linked to Canada Revenue. So if the employee does not want to use that name that is on the SIN, they need to request a new SIN. That's the best practice coming out of the Canadian Payroll Association.
Great. Let's move on to our SINs and talk about workplace training.
And I think this is, you know, a lot of our clients will ask, you know, what are the legal requirements in terms of training when I hire a new employee? What do we absolutely have to do from a legal perspective when we bring on a new employee? So we're going to, like Alex mentioned, talk about training requirements for new employees in three provinces, BC, Alberta, and Ontario. And you'll see some commonalities here and then some things that are particularly unique. If you do have any specific questions, whether it's relating to other jurisdictions, or anything more specific to your work environment, please don't hesitate to give us a call directly. So let's start with BC. The training requirements in BC, the required trainings, really fall under two pieces of legislation, which are health and safety related legislation. So Section 115 of the Workers' Compensation Act, and we've basically taken the verbiage right out of the Act, essentially requires employers to provide workers information, instruction, training, and supervision necessary to ensure the health and safety of those workers in carrying out their work, and to ensure the health and safety of other workers at the workplace. So generally speaking, what that means is that you have a general duty to ensure that your workers are provided with information, instruction, and training to ensure health and safety. That's going to obviously look different depending on your work environment, the role, et cetera. So there is just sort of that general duty, and you'll see that come up in other provinces. Specifically under the BC Occupational Health and Safety Regulation, particularly Part 3, which is titled Rights and Responsibilities, requires mandatory worker education, training, and certification in many cases. So there are some very specific areas of work that require very specific training. And sometimes where it's specified in the regulation, that training actually has to meet an acceptable training standard or be provided by a person or agency that has been vetted by Workplace BC. So again, this is more specific training that may be required in certain cases, and you may actually have to, you may not be able to do that in-house. It may be that you have to use one of the providers vetted by WorkSafe BC if your training doesn't meet acceptable standard. An employer in BC must ensure that before a new worker begins work in a workplace, the new worker is given health and safety orientation and training specific to that new worker's workplace. So this is before a new worker begins work. So again, for those in BC, when you are designing your onboarding program, this is something that you essentially want to do on day one, ideally.
And so here are the topics that are required in British Columbia as it relates to new workers' orientations and trainings. And I'll quickly run through this list. You can see it there, and it'll be there for reference purposes as well. But you got to have the name and contact information for the new worker's supervisor, the employers and the new workers' rights and responsibilities under Workers' Compensation Act and the regulation, including the reporting of unsafe work conditions and the right to refuse to perform unsafe work that must be clearly communicated to them. We have to train them on workplace health and safety rules, as well as any hazards that they may be exposed to as it relates to their work, including risks from robbery, assault, or confrontation. We're going to need to address kind of working alone or in isolation in that orientation. Obviously, kind of violence in the workplace also needs to be addressed in the training. If there's a personal protective equipment that the employee uses, they need to be kind of trained on the proper use of that. So whether that's eyeglasses, safety boots, those types of things, they need to be kind of trained on how to use those things properly. Obviously, it's not of any use to anyone just to say, here's your safety equipment. I kind of go forth, young one. They need to kind of put that stuff on. Some of it may be intuitive, but some of it may not be. And so we want to make sure that they are kind of well aware of kind of how to use that equipment or it doesn't protect anyone. Your training also needs to indicate where the first aid facilities are in your workspace, as well as a means of summoning first aid and reporting illnesses and injuries. You're going to also need to address any emergency procedures, whether that is any fire procedures or earthquake procedures, those types of things. We're going to need to also outline any instructions or demonstrations for the new workers' work tasks or work processes. So essentially, they need to be trained on the job that they are doing. They also need to be trained on any applicable health and safety program if that is required. If your workplace has anything that is potentially toxic, they need to be trained on the WMIS information requirements. Here are WMIS sheets, I think, for things as simple as liquid paper and those types of things. So, yeah. So some workplaces are going to have things, even if your workplace is an office environment, there will be a WMIS sheet available for a lot of things that you probably wouldn't think of. And then they also need to be aware of any contact information of the Health and Safety Committee, or if there's just a representative, who that representative is. Now, there's also additional training required for young or new workers if the workplace observation, which you are required to undergo, reveals that the new worker is not able to perform work tasks or work processes safely, or if requested by the new worker. So we have to provide additional training if requested, or if it's clear that they're not doing the job effectively or safely. And we also, lastly, of course, like most things, we want to make sure that we have all of our trainings documented, that each person has successfully gone through those trainings. So in case someone does show up at our doorstep for the administrator, we can kind of clearly show that all of our employees have been trained on the things that they are required to be trained on. back to Lindsay for Ontario unless there was a question.
Yeah, there was a couple of questions around the SIN. So I'm just going to jump back for 2 seconds. I think we can answer them fairly quickly. So one of the questions was, what if a new employee can't produce a SIN but claims that they have one? So is it just a matter of calling Service Canada to verify, or what's an alternative? I mean, at the end of the day, your obligation is to view the SIN.
Yeah, the actual card.
The card, or, and I should mention, I believe I've heard that Service Canada is moving away from the card, so an employee may actually just bring in a piece of paper. I think that's because of perhaps identity theft as well, and just the protection. But yes, your obligation is to view the SIN. And like Alex mentioned, they literally can walk into a Service Canada office and get that piece of paper printed with their SIN in one visit. So from a best practice standpoint, that's the instruction that I would be giving to the new employee. And I think a subsequent question was similar, which is, what if they don't have a physical one? So I think same answer. I mean, they may not have a physical card. So if you're finding that your new employees are coming in with a piece of paper from Service Canada, with the SIN on there, that is perfectly acceptable because, as I mentioned, Service Canada is moving away from the actual red and white cards. So if that's what you're getting, that's fine. If they don't have either, send them to a Service Canada office.
And if you have a question about the validity of that SIN, you could call it a number.
Yeah.
Cross-print that number with their actual name.
Absolutely. Okay, jumping back to training requirements, we're going to touch on Ontario now. So, just like BC, Ontario, under our occupational health and safety legislation, employers have a general duty to take all reasonable precautions to protect the health and safety of their employees. This includes a general duty to, again, instruct, inform, and so that general duty like in BC also exists in Ontario. Unfortunately, in 2014, the Ministry of Labour decided that this wasn't good enough, or perhaps realized that new employees were not getting sufficient health and safety training. And so as of July 1st, 2014, employers in Ontario have to ensure that all of their workers and supervisors complete a basic occupational health and safety awareness training program that has to meet certain regulatory requirements. So essentially, for your new employees, they are required to complete this training as soon as reasonably possible. So again, likely something that you want to build into your onboarding. And supervisors, they are required to get trained within 1 week of working as a supervisor. So there are two different trainings, one for worker, one for supervisor, and the regulatory requirements in terms of the content are different. So even if you had a worker received the training of a new employee and then became a supervisor 3 years later, they would have to undergo the supervisor basic occupational health and safety awareness training within 1 week of getting that promotion. You need to make sure to maintain a record of the training completed by your workers and supervisors, and you are required to provide a worker or supervisor with written proof of completion of the training if they request it. And that requirement lasts for up to 6 months after the employee ceases working for you. The reason for this is that an employee who switches jobs, if they can produce a certificate that they received this basic training already, you don't have to do it again. So you may, in fact, have employees who you are onboarding who bring their certificate from their previous employer and, in fact, may not have to do the training. So you are required to provide this written proof of completion. Okay, so also in Ontario, there is a requirement for employers to provide information and instruction to workers on the contents of violence and harassment policies and programs. And again, there's certain information that has to be included in this training. Workers need to know how to summon immediate assistance. They need to know how to report incidents of violence and harassment. They need to understand how the employer is going to investigate and deal with incidents, threats, or complaints. They need to know and understand and be able to carry out the measures that are in place, and then be able to carry out any other procedures that are part of the program. Your training really is going to be based on, especially from a violence perspective, a risk assessment that you would have completed for your particular work environment. So in terms of the actual violence program, it's going to look different depending on your work environment, and really the training should address that. Again, so it should take into account hazards associated with each specific job, as well as any measures and procedures that were put in place as a result of your violence and your violence risk assessment. So more for Ontario, there is a final training requirement as it relates to AODA, or the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act. So in Ontario, there are two areas that require training. The first is the customer service standards. So employers in Ontario are required to provide customer service to staff and volunteers, so that employees understand how to serve customers of all abilities. And there's also a component with respect to work-related accessibility training. So you're also required to provide employees with training on the areas of accessibility standards that are relevant to their particular work responsibilities, as well as the Ontario Human Rights Code, specifically where it relates to people with disabilities. So the AODA, so the three provinces that we're covering, the AODA legislation is a training requirement, are unique to Ontario. An added obligation.
And lastly, we are going to address some of the training requirements in Alberta, and those come out of health and safety legislation as well. And so there's going to be two general / specific duties in Alberta. And the general duty is that every employer must ensure that workers are adequately trained in all matters necessary to their health and safety. And this training must be done before the worker either begins to perform a work activity. So first thing first, they need to be trained 100%. And then if they're performing a new work activity or use new equipment or a new process, they need to be trained before they undertake that task. And they also need to be trained if they're moved to another area or work site. So that's your general duty. And specific duties, obviously, workers with jobs in certain areas are required by law to have government-approved health and safety training. And we listed some examples where that might apply, where there's asbestos worker training, audiometric technician training, explosive safety worker training, first aid training, and pulmonary function technician training. So there are going to be some specific job areas that are going to require specific training. Pause for question here.
Yeah, well, there's just a quick question with respect to violence and harassment training, whether it should be part of the onboarding or does it need to be done by a third party? Is there specific training? So, I mean, it really depends on the province. Generally speaking, you should be able to conduct this training in-house. Certainly, you know, using a third party like E2R, you know, this is certainly balanced harassment training is likely one of our most popular trainings that we deliver, and so we are always, of course, happy to do that. There is no, you know, there's no specific training, because really as it relates to violence or your complaint procedure or your protocols and procedures and measures is going to vary by employer. So there really isn't sort of just a blanket presentation. It does need to be customized. Ideally, it is done on onboarding. I mean, this is legally required, and so there's no reason why we should sort of delay in terms of getting this information to our new employees.
And then on that point, just kind of the things that need to be addressed in Alberta as it relates to workplace violence and harassment training, we must instruct workers on the following four things. One, the obvious hazards of workplace harassment and violence. You need to advise them on how to recognize the signs of danger, which will be workplace specific. You're going to face a different danger when you are in a customer facing role versus in a non-customer facing role. So it's all going to relate to your workplace assessment that you should be doing. It is legally required in certain provinces. It's probably a good idea to do it in all provinces, quite frankly, to assess what the possible dangers of workplace violence are as it relates to your particular workplace. Then we're going to need to make sure that they know what to do about it. That could be what to do about it in an immediate sense, or what to do about it on an ongoing sense if they feel like they're being harassed by a coworker or a manager, et cetera. They've gone through informal means what they should be doing about it at that point, and also on how best to report it, so like where to report it to. Is that HR? Is that their immediate manager? Is that someone else? Some kind of designated person, et cetera? Which most of these things will all be included in your actual kind of policy, which will come from the basis of your training document. But we just kind of make sure that we hit all of those high points in order to kind of satisfy the ministry that we have complied with our training requirements in Alberta.
And, you know, obviously this training is all very health and safety heavy, but I think it's important to look back on some of the notes that Alex gave at the beginning, which is, you know, the reason why there's so much emphasis on health and safety training is because, you know, in WorkSafe BC, more than half of workplace accidents involving new workers occur during the first 6 months. So new workers are more prone to workplace accidents. And so, you know, various ministries just want to make sure that employers are doing their due diligence to make sure that your new workers are properly, extensively, in some cases, trained. Okay, so in conclusion, you know, I think onboarding still continues to be a challenge for a lot of organizations. You know, if we think back to that survey where employees were surveyed and only 12% strongly agreed their organization did a good job in onboarding. But, you know, really, if we think about it, it is worth the time and energy to invest in developing a program, because it can reduce the amount of time before a new employee is productive. It will increase your retention rates, and it will ensure employee engagement from day one, which will all result in more effective employees, more productive employees, and a more profitable company. The right approach, proper onboarding, will lead to individual and corporate success overall. So thanks again. I think Alex mentioned our next e-learning is
October 25th.
Mark your calendars.
Be there, be square, or be, you know, be there.
Be there or be square. Take care, everyone.
Bye for now.